Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on 1 Second After when we come back. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity, from bank deposits to medical visits, has produced greater efficiency and security, all right. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, the federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. Closer to home, state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems. These systems contained 10,799 categories of information, and each one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records about New York residents. Now, information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how your government, banking, insurance, business, and industry is obtaining all this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for? You know, knowing how this information is being gathered, and what information is being stored, and what information you want to keep personal and private, actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package, and I'll tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package. All right, we're talking about EMP. That's called an electromagnetic pulse. It was first discovered right coming out of the chute in 1945 with the first atomic explosion. It was minor. The first atomic bombs were small, and they didn't have the same kind of accoutrements that go to the EMP production that we see in later models of thermonuclear weapons, that's hydrogen bombs. But in 1962, both the United States and the Soviet Union tested these thermonuclear weapons in atmospheric blasts, and what they found out from it was truly revelatory. There's a potential here for knocking out all of the electric grid of an entire nation, like the United States of America, with just one of these thermonuclear weapons exploded over Nebraska or Kansas. Could knock everything out coast to coast and border to border. Now that's a weapon. And it will knock out things like your water, sewer, phone, lights, computers, radio, television, automobiles. Any and everything that runs on electricity. We know it can be done from the northern lights. It was done called the Faraday effect in 1859. It's been tested in simulators. In fact, our government is well aware of it. The Army, the military, is prepared for it. Some of the phone companies and communications companies are prepared for it, and all the rest of us have never even heard about it. That's what's so amazing, and I mentioned this to you the other day. The phone companies are hardened, but none of us, the customers, are. Your cell phone gets knocked out, my cell phone gets knocked out, you and I can't talk. Although the telephone exchange down here is hardened, and if we had telephones to talk on, we could call. So we're reviewing a book here called One Second After. It's written by a fellow named William R. Forstchen, F-O-R-S-T-C-H-E-N, One Second After. Make sure you get a copy of it. It's good reading. It's entertaining. And when you get to the end of it, you're going to see that there's a problem that needs to be solved. Your government's not going to solve it for you. You can solve it for yourself. I showed you about these Faraday cages. And our dependence upon electricity. For instance, if you're going to have a water problem, then you need to solve your water problem before this happens. You need to have a source of water. Sewer. You got to have a place to dispose of your waste. If you're living on the 82nd story of the John Hancock Tower in downtown Chicago, you are screwed. You're on the 82nd floor, you got no way to get water. No water, no sewer. What are you going to do there, partner? No elevator, no lights. Mull it over a little bit and think about it. The cities will be absolutely untenable, unlivable. And we're not talking about Y2K that's going to last for a week or 10 days or a month. We're talking about years. Years. This can threaten the entire fabric of the nation. Millions of people will die when this thing comes down. You won't have any transportation. You won't be able to get food from California. See, one of the technological marvels of America is that we have all this food. We can move strawberries and lettuce from California to New York in 5 days. That's why you people in New York don't have lettuce and strawberries of your own. We can produce them cheaper and ship them to you from California. Now, if there's no trains and if there's no trucks, or very few of them, hey, you're not going to have lettuce and strawberries in New York City. You'll have them in California, but you won't have them out in the East, and we depend upon that. No oranges from Florida. How do you like that? No almonds from California. No wheat from Kansas. You see, we all of us depend upon this interdependent web of transportation and just-in-time delivery in our supermarkets and in our auto parts store. Well, after this EMP goes off, and 3 days later, and Mr. Forstchen, who is the author of the book, is opining here that his father-in-law, Tyler, in the rest home, after 3 days, might need somebody to come and visit him. Now, nobody's thought too much about Tyler over in the rest home since everybody's been scrambling here, trying to figure out where their next meal's coming from and where they're going to get a gallon of gas and who's got a car that runs and who doesn't. Well, John, the hero of the story here, has a 58 Edsel and it's running. So he's got wheels, at least for a while. And he decides to go up to the rest home. Now, what do you think is going to happen to a rest home that doesn't have electricity for 3 days? Now, right away, you're going to say to yourself, well, big deal. They'll start their generator. Remember, we've been talking about that. All of these generators, everything that's new now is electronic. It's got electronic ignition. It's got electronic this and electronic that. Even if it's diesel, it's electric. And the things get knocked out. They get fried right there on the spot. You can't start one. You can't shut it off. You can't use it. It's got to be repaired. Now, when people work in a rest home, I remember my wife worked in a hospital in Boise, Idaho, one time. She's a nurse. And she's up here in the hospital. Now, Boise isn't all that big a town. We could have walked over there. It was probably about 2 miles from our house. But she'd get in the car and she'd drive over to the hospital, the Veterans Hospital, up there by the federal building someplace. We were living over on the first bench, so that's about a 2-3 mile run over there. Now, let's suppose that we live 15 miles away in Nampa. Do you think anybody's going to walk 15 miles to work and 15 miles back home? Not in America, they're not. I can't even imagine somebody walking 2 or 3 miles to work, although that's certainly within the realm of possibility. I mean, we could do that. Nobody does. And here's the rub. This nursing home has 30 employees. And when this bomb goes off, there's a staff there, and they're working in the hospital. Well, let me read you a couple of pages here. Listen to what happens. He had promised Jen that they'd go see Tyler today, then make a run up to her house to get some clothes and, of course, check on the cat. So John got back in the car. It was only a short drive up to the nursing home, just about a mile. They passed half a dozen abandoned cars, a family walking by in the opposite direction, mother and father both pushing supermarket shopping carts, one with two kids inside, and the other stacked with a few family treasures. Who they were, he didn't know. Where they were going, he could not figure out, nor did he stop to inquire. Things had changed so much. A week ago, seeing a couple like that, he'd have pulled over and asked if they needed a lift. The sight was so pathetic. As they pulled into the parking lot of the nursing home, John instantly knew something was terribly wrong. Three people were wandering about outside. He could see they were patients, shuffling, confused, one of them naked. "My God, what's going on here?" Jen gasped. John started walking towards the nearest of the wanderers to guide her back inside, but Jen shouted for him to follow her. The moment he opened the door, he knew something was horribly wrong. The stench was overwhelming, so bad that he gagged, backed out, and gasped for breath. Jen, made of far sterner stuff, just stood in the doorway. "Take a few deep breaths. I'll be down in Tyler's room." John waited for a moment, tempted to light a cigarette. He held back, having gone through 5 packs in just 2 days. That left him with just 6 packs plus the 2 cartons that he was already beginning to count each one. He took another deep breath, braced himself, and he went in. Again the stench, the feces, the urine, the vomit. He gasped, he struggled, nearly vomiting, but fought it down. The corridor, which a week before had been so brightly lit and spotless, was dark. A large linen gurney parked in the side alcove was the source of the worst of the smell. He quickly walked past it, turned the corner, and reached the West Wing's nursing station. One woman was behind the counter and looked up at him wearily. Her gown of Winnie the Pooh's was stained and stained again. He spotted her name tag, Carolyn, and vaguely remembered that she was usually part of the night shift. Overcome with exasperation, John wanted to know, but could not see, and was exhausted and beleaguered. "How are you, Carolyn?" he inquired. "Fine, I guess," she said woodenly. He looked down the corridor. The stench was so overwhelming that he felt it should be a visible fog. "What in the hell is going on here?" he asked. "What do you mean?" Carolyn responded. She was in shock. He could see that now. The poor girl was numbed, hollow-eyed. "When did you last sleep?" John inquired. She looked up at the clock on the wall. It was frozen at 4:50. Feeble cries echoed down the corridor. "Help me! Help me! Help me!" "A few hours last night," Carolyn responded. "Are there any other staff here?" John asked. "There's Janice down on the other wing. I think Waldo's still here, and that's about it." She nodded. "I'll be right back." He braced himself and started down the corridor. All exterior doors were open, but there was no breeze, and the heat was suffocating. yet another building designed for complete climate control and year-round comfort with computerized environmental controls. The windows don't even open. The small windows in each room and the temperature inside was as high, if not higher, than outside. The first room he looked into revealed an elderly woman. He remembered her as having Alzheimer's disease. She was rocking back and forth, sheets kicked off, lying in her own filth. In the next room, two elderly men, one sitting in a motorized wheelchair that no longer moved, the other man lying on a bed, the sheets drenched in urine. They both glanced up at him. "Son, could you get us some water?" the one in the wheelchair asked ever so politely. "Yes," John responded. He backed out of the room and went back to the desk. "Can I have a pitcher for some water?" She shook her head. "We ran out last night," she said. "What do you mean you ran out?" "Just that. There's no running water." "Don't you have a reserve tank? Aren't you supposed to have a reserve somewhere?" "I don't know," she said listlessly. "I think there's an emergency well that runs off the generator." "Oh, for crying out loud," John said. He opened the door to the hallway bathroom and recoiled, gagging. A woman was sitting on the toilet, slumped over, dead. Already the smell of decay was filling the tiny room. He turned and he went back down the main corridor to the kitchen, storming in. One elderly man was there, balanced on his walker. Heavy steel fridge door was open. A package of hot dogs in his hand. He was eating one cold. "Hi there," the man said. "Care for one?" And he offered the pack up. "No thanks," John said. John went over to the sink and turned on the taps. Nothing. Damn it. Back out in the dining area, he took the lid off of a large recessed canister that usually held ice. There was still some water in the bottom from the melted ice. And taking two juice cups, he filled them up and went back down the hall, returning to the room with the two old men. He handed each one of them a cup of water. "Thank God," the one in the wheelchair whispered, sipping on it. John had to hold the other cup so that the man in bed could sit up and drink it. The man in the wheelchair was wearing an old commemorative cap with big red one, Omaha Beach, 1944, emblazoned upon it. It had pins across the front, which John instantly recognized. Combat Infantry Badge, Silver Star, two Purple Hearts, miniature sergeant's chevrons. He felt sick, looking at the man who had sipped the last of the water in the cup and held it back up. "Son, I hate to bother you," the man whispered. "My chair just won't move. Would you mind getting me another drink?" "John, where in the hell are you?" It was Jen, her voice shrill. "Right here." "Sir, I'll be back shortly," John said, and he fled the room. He tried to not look into the rooms as he walked down the corridor. An elderly woman, naked, sitting curled up and crying. A sickly scent from the next room he dared to look in. A body of a bloated man, face yellowing with the beginnings of decay. Bedsheets kicked off in his final struggle. His roommate sitting in a chair, looking vacantly out the window. John reached Tyler's room. Jen was in the doorway crying. "We have to take him home," she said. For a moment, John thought Tyler, head back, face unshaved, was dead. The IV was still in his arm, gravity fed. It was empty. The feeding tube into his stomach was driven by a small electrical pump, the plastic container attached to it. Was empty. Well, I'm not going to sit here and bore you by reading the whole book, but let me just make a comment or two. Can you imagine what happens when the power goes off in a nursing home or a hospital? Imagine what life is going to be like when the power goes off in your apartment house. I first faced that back about 1970 when I was running the Raymond Apartments in Oakland, California. It's about a six-story building. It was 90 units, as I recall. And they had a big lobby downstairs. And one day, the power went off. which isn't anything big. You know, the power goes off, it's off for 30 minutes or so, and the power comes back on. But in this case, it was off for 8 hours. Well, of course, we didn't know how long it was going to be off, but after a first hour or two or three, the tenants began to congregate down in the lobby. And pretty soon, one old lady came over to my wife and said, "Can I use your bathroom?" Well, we said, "Of course." And so she went in and used the bathroom. Pretty soon there was a second and a third and a fourth. And then pretty soon word came, there's no water. And then it didn't take very long until the toilet wouldn't flush and the toilet was full of nasties. That was after about 4 or 5 hours. The elevator didn't work. The tenants couldn't get up and down the stairs. They're too old and feeble. Now, that was back in 1970, and when I saw that, I said, "Oh, my God." I was just a young fellow at that time. I said, "You know, if the power goes off, this city here is not going to be livable." It was one of the things that motivated me to get out of the city. I said, "Uh-oh, this isn't going to work." Now, just a few years before, I couldn't wait to leave the farm to get to the city where all the money and all the activity and all the excitement was. Now I'm in the city. I've been down there for about 5 or 6 years, and I said, "Uh-oh. Hey, this thing isn't going to work very good." Forshin does a good job of describing, time after time, the everyday events that occur when you take for granted the things, the services that you use, like the traffic control lights. The traffic control lights, they work, and then everybody comes up to the stop sign. You may get angry and say, "This light stays red too long." And thank God there's a light there that turns from red to green and green to red to regulate the traffic, because without it, there would be just chaos. Nobody could get anywhere. Nobody could do anything. The fact that there's order. And that's the thing that counts. And here in the nursing home, there's no order. Instead of 30 employees, there's three. Three. And they got the same number of patients. There's no water. There's no drugs. There's no refrigeration. There's no food. The kitchen doesn't work. And you've got all these people in here, elderly people. People that are incapacitated, unable to take care of themselves, and you don't have a staff that can get to work to take care of them. Not that any of the staff in a crisis like this even wants to go to work. And the people that are there can't get home. Their cars don't work. They couldn't leave and just leave these people with nobody there. So the skeleton staff from the night shift stayed on. But when it's all said and done, they were overwhelmed and they couldn't take care of the people that were there. And respirators don't work, so people die. Drugs can't be administered and people die. You can't even call the undertaker. The telephone doesn't work. The undertaker's hearse doesn't work. The ambulances don't work, and you can't get the bodies out of the nursing home down to the undertaking parlor. The undertaker can't bury anybody, can't get anybody to go do anything. The backhoe doesn't work and you can't dig graves. Those are the problems that they're talking about in a little town of 10,000. Day by day, as this thing unfolds. Hey, this is what we're looking at. Instead of health care legislation, boys and girls, Congress could be doing us a big service over here if they'd solve this problem first. This is something that needs solving. I didn't have a problem with health care. I still don't. But I do have a problem with EMP. And so do you, and so does everybody else. And just because it hasn't happened yet doesn't mean that it isn't going to. Now, we need a solution to this. We need a solution. Now, most of the people that I talk to, or most of the people that call here, say, "We need to vote for this guy, or we need to vote for that guy. We need to repeal this health care legislation." Boys and girls, hell is going to freeze over before you repeal health care legislation. You heard the president. He was pretty damn cocky. I challenge you guys to repeal it. The Democrats had this supermajority and barely got it passed. You think a minority is going to get it repealed? You think the voters of America are going to vote the Democrats in and vote in the Team A or Team B to come in there and repeal it? Come on. Let's wake up and smell some coffee here, shouldn't we? Now, there is a potential solution to this problem on a massive scale, on a national scale. And believe it or not, it comes from the Bible. So I thought I'd share that with you. It's over in Genesis chapter 18, and it deals with a guy by the name of Abraham in a deal that came down centuries ago now. It was around, 1800 B.C., 1900 B.C., in a place called Sodom and Gomorrah. Do you remember that from Sunday school? Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, let me give you a little background in this story over here, because this is a pretty important story. The United States of America, Australia, Canada, New Zealand could be saved. In fact, you know, I've said to you Canadians, I said, you know, as America goes, you're going. I mean, you're in this deal with us. When we go, you go with us. To you Australians, I've said, and New Zealanders, look north. Pay attention. Look up there to the north on your map. Can you see a billion Chinese up there? Now take a look at Australia. How many people are down there? 20 million? About the same population as Shanghai, China. One city. They're going to be on you like flies on stink. And the only thing that keeps those guys off of you is the nuclear umbrella of the United States of America. And when we go out, you go out with us. Rest assured. Indeed, the entire panoply of Western civilization, the industrialized West, the Israelite countries of Europe and North America are dependent upon the United States of America. We're the guys that keep all the rest of you guys safe. We're the guys that keep the Russians and the Chinese off your backs. If it wasn't for us, the Russians would already be running Paris and London and Frankfurt. If it wasn't for America, the Chinese would already be in Sydney and Melbourne and Tasmania. Now, one of these days, they're going to succeed in destroying the United States of America. They've been working on us now for about 100 years. They've got us weak. They've got us vulnerable. They got us on the ropes. The economy is about to collapse. We're bankrupt, along with Great Britain and Ireland, Scotland, Spain, Portugal, Greece. I mean, we're all broke. And our enemies are sitting over there rubbing their hands, you know, like Simon Legree, waiting for the day. One Chinese general put it this way, he says, just biding our time, just waiting for the time when we can strike. And when we do, we'll make sure it's fatal. They're just biding their time and waiting. Now listen, there is a God in heaven, and there's a guy here by the name of Melchizedek, mentioned in chapter 18. Here in Genesis, this Melchizedek was the guy that later became Jesus Christ in the New Testament. Now, this guy has been dealing with a fellow by the name of Abraham. Carry this back now to about the 19th or 20th century B.C. We're in a place here in the Middle East, 65 miles from Jerusalem, down on the Dead Sea. There's a plain down there, and it was called Sodom and Gomorrah. And there were five cities out here on this plain. There was three others beside the two. There's all five of them were destroyed, but three of them were pretty small, and two of them are pretty good size. Now, to give you a little perspective here, Josephus said that Sodom and Gomorrah had a population of about 100,000 each. That's 200,000 people living there. Modern skeptics, they say, we don't believe that for a minute. There wasn't one more than 10,000 there. For the purposes of our story here today, it doesn't make any difference whether there was 100,000 or 100 million or 10,000 or 275. There were some people that lived there, and they were all killed one day. But there was a story that came down along with this program, this destruction. And it went something like this. Melchizedek shows up with two angels. So here's Jesus with two angels. And he comes over to Abraham's place about halfway between Jerusalem and Sodom and Gomorrah. And here's Abraham sitting in his tent door in the heat of the day. And these three guys show up. He recognizes them immediately. And he says, "Hey, fellas, why don't you come on in, wash your feet. Why don't you sit down under the shade tree over there, and I'll go get a fatted calf. I'll have the wife make us up some cakes, and we'll have some lunch here this afternoon. Have an early dinner." So they said, "Well, yeah, go ahead and do that." And so he goes out and kills a fatted calf, and Sarah makes some cakes, and pretty soon they sit down and they have dinner, and they're there talking about business and one thing and another and politics. And pretty soon Abraham looks over here at Jesus, Melchizedek, and he says, By the way, what brings you this way? And here's Jesus. He says, "I'm on my way to Sodom and Gomorrah." And he said, "Well, what are you going to do over at Sodom and Gomorrah?" He says, "I'm going over there to destroy the two cities." And Abraham was just shocked out of his gourd. He said, "You're going to what?" Yeah, and Jesus said, "Well, I've heard some pretty bad reports about those two places. And I'm going over to see if it's true. And if it's true, I'm going to destroy both of them." Now, a conversation develops. Once Abraham understands what the purpose of this meeting is and where this guy Melchizedek is going, he says, "Well, wait a minute. Hang on a second here. His nephew Lot and his wife and their children and no doubt a lot of friends and business associates. I mean, after all, this guy Abraham has 318 servants. He has somewhere in the neighborhood of 300,000 acres of land, 31,000 head of cattle, God knows how many sheep. He's selling this at today's market prices. He's turning in around $6 to $8 million a year. The guy's about 100 years old at this moment in time, round numbers, 99. Making $6-8 million a year. He's worth about $175 million. And he's 35 miles away from two population zones of about 100,000 each. So, you know, I got to thinking about that, and I said, "I'll bet you Abraham had a bunch of commercial property and real estate and a bunch of investments in Sodom and Gomorrah. I'll bet you he had a string of restaurants, a butchering, or a packing plant over there. I bet you had some downtown real estate, stores and storefronts, a couple of brokerage houses, probably had some apartment houses. Well, that's what I'd have if I had $175 million and I was 35 miles from downtown San Francisco and Oakland, California. That's what I did." And a conversation develops. And Abraham asked Jesus, he said, "Now, wait a minute. What if there's 50 righteous people that live over there in Sodom and Gomorrah? Would you kill the 50 righteous along with the wicked?" And, you know, Melchizedek mulled that one over for a minute, and he looked over at Abraham. He said, "Well, no, I wouldn't do that. No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't kill the righteous people in the city with all of the wicked. Even though there's 100,000 wicked over there, hell, if there was 50 righteous, I would save the entire city for the sake of 50 righteous out of 100,000. Well, boys and girls, it's halfway time, and that's a hell of a statement. Mull that one over for a minute, and we'll be back here in a bit, and we'll talk about that. Meanwhile, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you would like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to endorse and recommend us. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go down, or please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, there's a solution here to our problem nationally. If here in the United States we said to ourselves, how many people would we have in this country in order to impress God with a program that he wouldn't destroy the nation? I said he's going to destroy us. And we got that from Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21. The whole book of Ezekiel is written about the house of Israel. And with specificity, Ezekiel zeroes in on us, the United States of America, and says our cities are going to be destroyed and laid waste. Now, that being the case, what would we have to do to convince God that we were worthy or deserved a second chance? As I mentioned earlier, now, most people think of this in political terms, and they say, we got to vote the Democrats out and vote the Republicans in. Next guy says, we got to vote all the incumbents out. Well, from my perspective, I took a look at that, and I said, you know, if these people have the answer, if voting is the answer to our problem, then we shouldn't have a problem to start with, because we've been voting now for 230 or 40 years. And with all this voting, we've voted all these bad guys into office. So if we've already voted all these bad guys into office, what makes you think we're going to vote the bad guys out and vote the good guys in? I mean, we haven't been able to tell who the good guys and the bad guys are in the last 230 or 40 years. What makes you think we're going to do it between now and November? So I don't hold out much hope for this voting thing over here. I wish you all the luck in the world. Get out there and vote the bad guys out. I've been unable to identify all these bad guys. I think I know who they are, but, you know, we thought George Bush was a good guy when we voted him in twice, didn't we? You know, as we go back through history, you know, we always thought these guys were pretty good guys when we voted them in, didn't we? I mean, you didn't vote for a bad guy on purpose now, did you? Well, now, going back here to Melchizedek, he says to Abraham, he said, you know, if there was 50 righteous over there, I wouldn't destroy that place. Now, there's 100,000 people, or there's 10, whichever the number you want. You got 10,000 people over there and 50, he says. If there's 50 righteous in this little town of 10,000, that's what the story is all about here in one second after. It's a little town in South Carolina with 10,000 people. And that's what they're talking about. God would have saved that little town if there had been 50 righteous in it. Well, once he got the commitment out of God that he wouldn't destroy the place for 50 righteous, Abraham thought about that for a minute. He says, geez, what if we were short five? What if I go over there and I'm knocking on doors looking, hey, are you righteous? Hey, I'm looking for 50 righteous here in Sodom. Do you know of any other righteous people around town? So he said to him, well, peradventure there be 5 short of 50. What if there's only 45? God mulled that one over a little bit and he said, well, I'll tell you. I wouldn't destroy the place if there was 45 righteous. So Abraham got thinking about that and said, well, what if we were short 5 there and we only had 40? And he said, I wouldn't destroy it for the sake of 40. 35? No, sir. No, sir. I wouldn't destroy the place if you could come up with 35 righteous. How about 30? Well, God mulled it over a little bit, and he said, well, 30? No, I probably wouldn't destroy the place if you could come up with 30 righteous. 25. If there was 25 righteous men, or 25 righteous women in Sodom and Gomorrah, no, I said I wouldn't destroy the place for 25. How about 20? How about 15? How about 10? How about 5? And here's God, you know, they're having a conversation. They just finished lunch, chewing the rag a little bit. Where are you going? I'm going over to Sodom and Gomorrah. What are you going to do when you get there? I'm going to kill all those people over there. Now, I got to tell you a little story. I was watching PBS last night, and they had the program on there called The American Experience. And they were talking about World War II and Japan and the kamikazes and the fierce defense that the Japanese put up in World War II. And there was a B-29 bomber pilot that was being interviewed on there, and he said, I came from America, and I was religious, and I came over here, and I worked on this Tokyo bombing where we killed 100,000 people. We firebombed Tokyo, killed 100,000 people. And he said, that really bothered me, killing those people. And I wrote a letter home to my pastor, and I asked him about it. And my pastor wrote me a letter, and he said, only God knows why those 100,000 people had to die. We don't know. And I watched that program, and I said, well, hell, I'm just a plumber, and I know why they had to die. I know why God killed them. And I know why he used the United States of America to do it. And that's not because I'm so smart. It's because I read the scriptures. I just took a look at what he said. And he tells you very plainly in here, here's why I did this, or here's why I'm going to do this. I mean, this God here in the Bible, he's pretty open, straightforward, you know. he's actually a pretty good guy, you know, when you get to know him a little bit. He doesn't put up with a lot of nonsense. He's kind of a no-nonsense kind of guy. My dad was like that. He had a good sense of humor, but he didn't put up with a lot of BS, you know. So anyway, Abraham cooked this deal with him, and he said, if there's 10 righteous in the city, I won't destroy it for the sake of 10. And the three guys left, and they went over to Sodom and Gomorrah, and they started looking around for 10 righteous, and they found 4. A little bit short of the goal. They found Lot, his wife, and 2 daughters. Now, there possibly could have been some more. The daughters were married, and the son-in-laws wouldn't leave town. Possibly, you know, they might have been pretty good guys, I don't know. But anyway, when it was all said and done, they could only find 4. Now, here's an important part of the story. One of the angels comes over to Mrs. Lot. Now, Mrs. Lot was not really all that righteous. She's a pretty good lady, I'm pretty sure. But Mrs. Lot wanted to stay there in Sodom. She really didn't want to leave. And she sure as hell didn't want to leave with the clothes on her back. So she called a U-Haul truck, see, and she was waiting for the movers to come. And the two angels came over, and they said, look, Mrs. Lot, one of them pointing at his watch. And he said, we got to blow town. Now. Let's go. And don't look back. So Lot and Mrs. Lot and the two daughters, they left town. They were on foot, I guess. I don't know, they might have taken a cab, but more than likely they were on foot, kind of what the Sunday school lesson told me anyway. So that's always what I've had in my mind, although it never did say how they left town. Anyway, as they were leaving town, Mrs. Lot turns around and looks back. She's turned into a pillar of salt. The other three didn't look back, and that's because they all escaped. Because had they looked back, they too would have been pillars of salt. So that's how I know the other three didn't look back, is because only Mrs. Lot was turned into a pillar of salt. Now, Mrs. Lot was not anxious to leave in the first place. So if I told you, hey, it's time to blow out of San Francisco because there's a nuke coming, you might be tempted to call the U-Haul people and ask for the moving company to come get your stuff. But it might be incumbent upon you to just get the hell out of town. Well, now you remember the Sunday school story, fire and brimstone came down, wiped out the cities, and killed all the people in them. All the people that were in them. They all died. Now, it doesn't really make a lot of difference whether there was 100,000 in there or 10,000. That's not the drift of the story here that I'm telling you. What I'm telling you is that God, the creator of the universe, who says that he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He said that in Hebrews 13. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. He says, I am the God that cannot lie, and I change not. That's the basis of what we call in law the doctrine of stare decisis. Once settled, always settled. So we got a pretty important piece of information here, kids. And what that tells us is that the standards that he established at Sodom and Gomorrah are still binding on him today. If we could blow into town and if we could produce 50 righteous in San Francisco, California, he'd have to save the whole city for the sake of 50 righteous. If we could produce 50 righteous in New Orleans, which evidently we couldn't do because he destroyed the city. Leave New Orleans out of this. I think those guys are toast. But let's go over to Oakland, California, or Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, you know. Now, he's telling us over and over again, I'm going to destroy you people. I'm going to destroy you because of your sin. Sin. Sin is the transgression of the law. Well, what law did we transgress? The Ten Commandments. That's what our problem is. See, we threw away the Ten Commandments. Now we're practicing the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. You know, like sending your kids to public school. You know, 10th plank, practicing this heavy progressive income tax. The second plank, like using Federal Reserve notes and the Federal Reserve Bank, plank number 5. You know, and on it goes. I mean, you know, we're practicing all 10 of these. And so as a result of that, he says, you know, I'm going to kill all you people for that. That's what Ezekiel 5 is all about. And he tells Ezekiel, you know, hey, go shave your head. Divide your hair up into three little bunches over here. The first bunch over here is going to get killed in the siege. Second in the war. And the third are going to be taken away captive into all the nations. But he said, save a few hairs and bind them up in your skirt. Save a few of them. Those are the people that are pictured in Revelation chapter 3. You know, that sixth church, that little group called the Philadelphians. All right, well, leaving that aside, now that you know why God's so ticked off, see, he made a contract with us. That's what the bitch is. He made a contract with us, and we breached the contract. We not only breached it, we gave him a finger while we were breaching it. And then that kind of ticks him off. And then every once in a while he goes postal. Now, you know that because of what happened in Noah's time. He killed everybody in the world. You know that because of what happened at Sodom and Gomorrah. He killed them all. You know that because of what happened to Pharaoh and the Egyptians at the Red Sea crossing. He killed them all. The guy doesn't take prisoners. So every now and again he goes postal on us, and he kills a bunch of people. Now he's about to go postal on us again. He's been telling us over and over and over again. You know, he says, listen, I'm about had it with you clowns, and then I'm going to come unhinged here in a minute. Well, it's been going on for so long. I mean, this guy, you know, he says, well, you know, vengeance is mine, and I will repay. And he tells us that he's long-suffering. That means he's got a lot of patience, and this goes on and on and on and on. Pretty soon, it goes on for so long, people, you know, kind of give up, and they say, I don't believe it for a minute. I don't believe this is going to happen. I don't believe in the second coming. I don't believe God is going to punish us. I don't believe God is going to destroy us. And so then we get kind of uppity until one day, finally, the shoe falls, and then we all get sad, and we start crying. Then people want to pray, you know. Get all religious. So here's Abraham over here. He's made the offer over here, and so that offer is still good today. Now let's extrapolate that out. Let's suppose that here in the United States of America, that we could come up with how many people would we have to come up with if he needed 10 out of 100,000? Let's just plug that in. Here's 100,000. I plugged that into my Sharp EL1197 here. Let's just divide that by 10. We would only need 10,000 people. You know, if you could find 10,000 people, you know, just 10 out of 100,000. Well, let's go a little bit further than that. We've got 300 million here in this country, don't we? Let's go 300 million. 300 million people in the country. Now, we need the same ratio of people, that is 10 out of 100,000 would be 10,000 people. So if we took that 10,000 and divided it into 300,000, so divided by 10,000, we'd need 30,000 righteous men and women here in the United States. That's it. Now, do you think that there's 30,000 righteous men and women here in the United States? Do you think you could go into San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, and find 30,000 Americans that practice the Ten Commandments or the statutes and the judgments? Do you think you can find 30,000 Americans that keep the Sabbath, Fourth Commandment, or that practice the Passover? Let me ask you this. Do you know of anybody that keeps the Sabbath or practices the Passover or the Feast of Tabernacles? Now, there was a fellow by the name of Elijah. And old Elijah was a little bummed out one day. You'll read about this. It's in 1 Kings chapter 18, if I remember right. Or thereabouts, you know, 16, 17, 18, 19, along in there. And he's kind of grousing about the way things are going. And he said to this angel, he said, you know, I'm the last man in Israel to practice this law, and they seek my life. Ahab and Jezebel were out trying to kill this guy. He's a wanted man. He's being hunted. He's on the run. The guy's hiding out for 3.5 years in the wilderness. The guy's on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. You know? He's on America's most wanted. John Walsh is after Elijah, trying to catch him. Gonna bring him to justice. And then he was a little bummed out, and he says, I'm the last guy in the country here to practice this law. And you know what that angel said to him? His name is Big Mike. It was Big Mike, and he said, oh, no, Elijah, hey, wait a minute. I have reserved 7,000 in this country that have not bowed their knee to Baal. 7,000. Now, I would say, people ask me that once in a while, I say, you know, here in the United States, there's probably 7,000 that have not bowed their knee to Baal. Now, you people down in Australia, have you got 7,000 in Australia that keep the Sabbath, do the Passover and the Feast of Tabernacles? Could you point to anybody down there? Because if you could, you could pull this on God. You know, we might be able to pull the fat out of the fire here. Pull the fat out of the fire. Now, of course, you know, the skeptics, they come along and say, well, there was only 10,000. Well, then you got to come up with a few more people. If there was only 10 there and you got 300 million today, we'd have to come up with about 300,000 instead of 30,000. So I hope that there was 100,000 in Sodom and Gomorrah, and the ratio is 10 per 100,000 instead of 10 per 10,000. But then, you know, whatever the number happens to be, I think you're going to be hard-pressed to find them, just like Abraham was a little hard-pressed to find 10. All right, now that puts us in a kettle of soup here, because if that's the case, then this thing is toast, this thing is going down the tubes, and it's just me and you. You know, you're going to save your ass, and I'm going to save mine, and that's about as far as any of us are going to get on this deal. So that's why I thought I'd bring this to your attention. Now, this EMP thing over here, I think, is one of the perfect storms. If I've ever heard of a perfect storm, I mean, this has got to be the perfect storm. We have spent 100 years building this nation and making it as vulnerable as it is. I've mentioned to you time and again that, hey, listen, the food supply on planet Earth in 1970 was 73 days for everybody on the planet. Today it's down to 38 days. And we Americans are importing our food, half of it, from around the world. Do you think that that is safe? Do you think that's a good policy? Now we've got this EMP problem. I put this on number 65. We've already got 64 life-threatening problems that came to us from Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. And now all of a sudden we got this EMP problem. We've always had the nuclear problem, but this EMP thing over here, all of them by itself, threatens us. So I said, hey, wait a minute. Now we got to take care of that one. Each and every one of us has these same 65 life-threatening problems. And you'll solve all 65 of them, because if you get 64 of them solved and you fail on one of them, you're dead. D-E-D and dead on arrival. So we got to solve all 65. All 65 of them are revealed here in the Scripture. And then furthermore, God comes along and says, hey, Ezekiel, I want you to take a handful of those hairs, just a few of them, bind them up in your skirts, because I'm going to protect a certain number of people here. I'm going to save the guys, those 10 righteous. We're not going to kill the righteous with the wicked. It's a principle of law. If you practice the law, you will not die. You got that? All right. Now, with that, I got to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio logs, schedule, and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow.